It's a workshop on the value of doing a thorough fifth step. So that should be why you're here. To say that we don't do this like a regular meeting, but let's start with the serenity prayer anyway. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So one of the things I was tasked with on the committee and the program chair and found as I was going along what I was supposed to do, one of the things I was supposed to do was to make sure that there were chair people and topics for workshops and things like that. And so kind of winged it, and so I needed a topic for this workshop, and nobody gave me any suggestions, as people are wont not to do. So I thought about this. So when I got sober in Pittsburgh, there was an old-timer who was like the guy everybody went to, you know that guy, wherever you got sober. His name was Marty. And whenever anybody would drink or he'd hear that somebody went out, the first thing he would say is, "Did you do a fifth step?" And, you know, I've never forgotten that. It's a pretty important thing. And so that's what I was thinking about when I came up with a topic for this workshop. And then I had to assign people to be on the panel. And so I just, you know, I had never met Rush or Georgia before, but I put them on this panel. And then I heard them speak on Thursday and Friday and said, "Oh, my God, this is like magic, this stuff." You know? And just talking about transparency and honesty and all those things. And so I am really happy to be here myself because I'm really looking forward to hear what they have to say about this topic. So please welcome Rush and Georgia.
Good morning. I'm George. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jack. I'm excited to do this with you. I'm sorry I didn't hear him talk on Thursday night. I heard it was so good. So, yeah, I heard. I'm going to have to listen to the CD when I get home. But I'd like to have some ammunition this morning. I don't have anything. in a good way. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. And I'm so grateful to be sober. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. You know, when I came to AA, I couldn't go a day without drinking. I thought my problem was drinking. But if my problem was drinking, then setting aside the drink would have solved everything. But it's when I'm not drinking that I'm crazy. And it's when I'm not drinking that I make that insane decision to pick up another drink, which is insane because every time I pick up a drink, whether I promise you, whether I promise me, I'm always going to get drunk. Always. That's been my experience. I have proof. It's scientific proof. But that insanity, that pain that I have, that regret, I can't imagine today even the pain greater than regret. And so I try to live my life without that today. And so, when I got sober, I wanted to get through the steps quickly. One of the reasons was I liked a guy, surprise. And he was a comedian, and he used to do all these voices. And this is, I don't know why I'm sharing this right now. This always happens to me. I'm at a podium. I'm like, "Why are you saying this?" I'm like, "I don't know." But this guy was a comedian, and he did this Rain Man impression. He said, "Of course I couldn't date someone who hasn't done an inventory yet." And I'm like, "Oh, I want to date him. I better do my inventory." I remember how hard it felt. And I went around asking everyone, "How did you do your inventory? How long was it?" You know, I had a sponsor who outlined exactly what I needed to do, exactly from the book. But I am super anal retentive and have a desperate need for clarity, and so it just wasn't enough. And so I was asking everyone, and it was as if it was magic. Every meeting I went to, it seemed like the topic was inventory. I was going to meetings at this woman's house who had just had a hip replacement. And they're like, "What should our topic be?" And it's like, "Let's talk about the four step." I'm like, "Thank you." But here's the thing that I learned. I spent so much time worrying about doing it and not doing it and prepping to do it. We've been doing it for years, and I simply just needed to download the information to a piece of paper. Like, there was no work to do it other than downloading it. It's the things that filled my head all day, all night. It was that tape that kept playing. I just simply needed to take a pen to paper, and I believe in not doing it on a computer, like pen to paper. And I wrote my four step as if I wasn't going to do a fifth step. So I wrote everything, and maybe I won't share that. Maybe I won't share that, you know, because I was so ashamed of so many things that I had done. And so it took a couple months of this, like how many pages was yours, how many pages was yours. Well, and let me just back up. My sponsor said, I want you to write down all of your resentments. And I was so happy to be sober. I was so happy to have found a solution that I was like, well, I don't have any. And because I was in that, you know, newcomer bubble of joy, which, by the way, let me just say that I stayed in my pink cloud for my first 6 years. And when there were people in my group who said, oh, well, that pink cloud, that's going to pass. Wait until you turn two, you know. Wah, wah, wah. But I have found that joy that I found in being new is there as long as I do all the stuff. When I do the stuff, the equation is the joy that comes from it. But anyway, what was I saying? So back to, so my sponsor had told me she changed the language, write down everyone you've ever been mad at. And I was like, uh-oh. And I ended up with like 100 resentments, which took a couple of sessions, I think three, for me to actually read to her. But one of the things that she did before we started was she told me some of her secrets, and I was like, oh my God, like, what? You did what? Which kind of opened it up for me, to be honest. And that's one of the greatest things I found in this program, is that my being honest sets me free, but it also sets you free. Like, the more you're honest about your story, the more freedom I have to be honest. And one of the greatest freedoms that came from doing this inventory, besides like taking off that heavy pack I'd been carrying around for so many years and drinking over, was the freedom that there was one person who knew everything and still loved me. I did not know that was possible. There were people who knew bits and pieces, but there wasn't one person who knew everything and still loved me. And it was such a great, well, as I wrote my inventory, I was so excited to write that first column. I was like, yes, finally I get to make a list of all those sons of, And, you know, that was so great. And I wrote I've done it a couple different ways, so let me back up a little bit. I've done the steps the way my sponsor had done them. So my first sponsor did them differently than my sponsor now. So there were a couple of times I've gone through the steps. So I did it with Tracy, and who was my second sponsor and who I went through the steps with the first time. And she had said to write down all your resentments. So I wrote down all my resentments, and then I walked around just feeling angry. And then the second column, the first column and the second column, my resentment and why. And I just walked around feeling angry. And then I got to that third column, and then I walked around feeling depressed. And then I got to my fourth column, where we looked at, you know, where did we get the ball rolling and what were our faults. And then I walked around just feeling ashamed. And then finally I got to that point where I got to read it to her and really identify what my role was in all of those resentments. And some of them were really hard. And this is why it's so important to do with a sponsor. I've heard people say, oh yeah, I've gone through the steps a few times. One was somebody I was sponsoring. I'm like, you didn't do them with me. Who did you do them with? And she said, oh, I did them in a workshop. And I'm like, like, no matter how long I'm sober, I'm never going to be able to see my whole picture. You know, like, I'll never see this. If I'm 50 years sober, happy, joyous, and free, I still can't see this. I still need somebody from the outside, a sponsor in my case, who can see my whole picture. So, like, one of the things was my mom. You know, my mom was neglectful. She would rage and scream at me. You know, there were some physical things, you know, like, what's my fourth column there? You know, I had a really hard time. And she helped me see that it as a child, I did not have fault. It was now as an adult how I've used that. how I've used that over and over again to limit my usefulness to my fellows, how I've used that to drive a wedge in other relationships, how I've used that to punish her for years and years and years, you know. So it was interesting to see in some of those where I feel like I don't have any fault in this, to have a sponsor to help me identify that. So there was, I want to talk about, because let's see, I've got 5 minutes. I want to talk about, or actually I have more than that. The last inventory I did was when I was in that suicidal depression. And that inventory took me even longer to write because I was so depressed. It was just, I had let myself fall into this horrible hole of self-obsession and self-pity with double-digit sobriety, which then brought with it a side order of shame. Because AA had given me such a big and beautiful life, and I felt so much shame, and it was harder to talk about. It's really easy to talk about a wound, you know, like I broke my leg, I need help, or, you know, if somebody died, my heart is broken. But when you just have low-level depression and you really can't, there hasn't been, like, one big thing you can talk about, I felt like I had failed AA in some way. I'd been given this beautiful gift, and I was just full of uselessness and self-pity again now with double-digit sobriety. Now I know in hindsight it was because I was treating my physical pain by staying out of meetings and limiting my activity, which only made me more crazy. But when I made that decision, I shared last night that I got to a point where I realized I'd been depressed for like 2 years. I don't know where the time went, but I kept waiting to feel better to do something. But what I've learned from the beginning is that my actions lead my feelings, and I made that decision. I can't drink and I can't kill myself. You know, how do I best want to spend the rest of my wretched time on this hideous planet? And that's when I went through the steps again with Marilyn, who's been my sponsor now for 28 years. And that inventory was the biggest piece of crap I've ever written. It was, like, I felt like my first inventory was kind of exciting, and it had all my dirty little secrets, and there was all my adventures, and, you know, it was kind of, I didn't want to burn it or anything, like, I saved that. But this one was so petty, because what had happened is I started thinking that I couldn't talk about certain things, and I had petty resentments, like, the girls don't invite me to go, you know, when it's, I had a group of friends and they always celebrated each other's birthday, but not mine. You know, I had all these, you know, I went to the meeting and so-and-so never says hi to me. You know, I mean, they were so stupid and petty. But what I found out is that those are the things that kill us. It's not the big stuff. I can deal with big stuff really well. And that inventory, I think, was probably more significant for me, because it was really like, it was the deep, deep, deep stuff that I had never let go of all those previous years. And then to share it with a sponsor who I love and respect, who I want to love me, to really let her see who I truly was really deeply, and to have her still love me. And I've had so many experiences throughout my sobriety that had given me kinds of freedom that I never even knew existed or that I wanted. And this was one that today there's nothing you can know about me that can hurt me. If there's something I don't want you knowing, then I shouldn't do that thing. I shouldn't be worried that you're going to talk about it. Just don't do that thing that you feel ashamed about, you know? And, and I don't worry about what people are talking about. Like if I see, you know, it used to haunt me. If I saw people talking or I thought people were talking about me, I'd think about it like, I wonder what they're saying. I wonder if she said something, blah, blah, blah. I don't even worry about that because I know the truth will always be known by my actions. It may take longer, but people judge us by our actions, not by our intentions or our words, you know, and I just learned to live differently, and that freedom of, there's nothing you can know about me that can hurt me today is magnificent. I am the person that you see before you today in front of my board of directors at work, with the staff I manage, with my boyfriend, with my friends. I used to have different personas in different places, and I'm just the same everywhere now. And that was really out of this finally sharing everything with another person and still being loved. And it allows me to do that same thing. I think what we're going to do here is we're both going to share for like 20 minutes. And then we'll take questions if you guys have. And then if you have questions, you can just, like if you have a question for Rush or for me, like let us know which one. And we'll repeat it in the microphone so the taper will get it. And we'll be able to answer your questions that way. I think that's all I'm going to say for now. I'll wait for questions later and I'll turn it over to Rush.
Hey guys, I'm Rush. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Georgia. Thank you for leading us off here. Enjoyed your talk last night. I think about, because the inventory process has changed for me drastically over the years. I think about, one of the first meetings that I ever came to, it was a little place called the Gwinnett Room. And I remember sitting in that room and, back then I don't know, even know how old I was. I was probably, 17 or 18 years old, and I knew that my dad had gone to meetings there, and there was a bunch of old timers that I was familiar with, and there was cigarette smoke, and I mean, the place was just disgusting, I shared this in my story, but I remember looking around the room and just thinking, what a shithole life I have to look forward to, And so that was kind of the first experience that I had. And then the next thing that I remember is seeing those banners up on the wall. And in big, bold letters, I started going down the list of the steps. And I saw the word God, first of all, and I was like, oh, God, here we go. My experience with God was just, it was just not great. I was always a believer in something, but that part scared me. And then I went to the fourth step and I was like, okay, this is really not looking great here, And then I saw the fifth step, which suggested that I'm going to have to actually share my shit with another individual that I don't know, and I don't trust. And I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified, And then the next thought was, as we kept going down the line, I saw that ninth step, man, and I swear to God, I was just like right there in the Gwinnett Room. It was just not a pleasant experience for me. But there was something inside me that just told me, like, there's a solution here for you. And I had been told by some people that I loved and respected that if we go through this 12-step process, that something happens to us, right? Internally. And I knew that something had to happen to me if I was going to change. And I still didn't know anything about a psychic change. I didn't know any of that talk. But I just had the hope that if I went through this process, that some changes would be made within me. So that being said, when we're talking about the inventory process, the first, three steps were just kind of like, just kind of going through the motions. I understood the powerlessness and unmanageability. We talked about the God piece. Had no idea how to turn my will and my life over to the care of something. I just had no idea what that looked like. And really it was just me trusting, just kind of going through that process with this guy named Ed S. And I had a great experience because, and this is just kind of a side note, not related, but I have not seen Ed in a really, really long time. And that was the first guy that took me through the steps. And I heard that he got sick years ago. And I just kind of assumed that he had passed because we had lost touch. And I was sitting back there last night, watching the shit show going on up here after the meeting, which was hilarious, by the way. And I spotted him in that third row back there. And I got to go sit by him and shake his hand. It was just a really cool experience. He was there with his wife. I was just so happy to see the guy alive. And I was so happy to see the man that had taken me through that process for the very first time. It was just incredible. But with Ed, when I asked Ed to be my sponsor, it's hard to recall, like, where my mental state was. I would think that my mental state would have suggested that I just find somebody that looked cool. You know? But Ed was, there was something about the guy. Like, I just felt safe with him. You know? And the reason why I'm mentioning this is because I think that it plays a big role in this inventory process, that we find somebody that we feel safe with. Okay? That was my experience. My experience is that I've always been led to exactly the people that I need in that moment. And that's just the magic of this thing, you know, that we get to be a part of. I mean, I truly do believe that if I'm just putting one foot in front of the other and I'm trying my best to do the next right thing, that God meets me exactly where I am, you know, and I believe that that was, you know, that was divine, you know, for me to meet that man. And, you know, what I thought was going to take place in this, you know, because, I mean, I made the list, I did the thing, and I think it took me a couple of months, you know, to really kind of, you know, find the courage and the willingness to go through that process. And when I finally sat down and I made the list, I mean, it was probably 3 hours, you know, probably just 3 hours of my life, you know. And I love what George said about how we've been doing this shit for years. You know what I mean? Now we just have to download it, you know. That's beautiful, because, I mean, that was just exactly my experience. It's the only thing that keeps me from doing anything that I know I need to do is right here. It's right there. It's always right there. That's why I meditate every single morning. That is the process of disidentifying from my mind the thing that wants me dead. And I still believe that today. You know, but if I just sit down, I get a piece of paper, I get a pen, I start the process, you know, the magic starts to happen. And I put a lot down, I left a lot off. And again, I mean, this is back to why we choose the people we choose to do this with. Because Ed knew I was going to do that. Somehow he just knew, you know? And that was the beauty of it, you know? And what I thought was going to happen is I thought Ed was going to teach me how to forgive all these assholes. I mean, remember, this is my first time through this process. Totally clueless. I had no idea I was the asshole, you know? I had no idea, you know? And I remember going through the process with him, and it was fairly simple. I mean, of course I was nervous, you know, because I had that thing in the back of my mind. I feel like we all have that thing that we're like, am I going to share this? Am I not going to share this? Should I go find a preacher or a pastor or whatever? And, you know, we get to the end. It was probably an hour and a half or so. And Ed, he looked at me. He's like, before you get out of that car, I want to ask you a question. Is there anything left off this list? You know? And he knew. Like, he knew. And I do believe, I mean, I've taken that with me. In every fifth step that I've done with a new guy since, I have asked that question. I believe as sponsors, it is our responsibility to dig. We have to do that. Because I don't think that they have the capacity to do that all the time. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they just come in here torn and broken, and they're just ready. And you don't have to tell them to really do anything. They're just great sponsees. But I do believe, you know, especially in my case, man, I needed somebody to dig, and I'm so grateful that he did. Because I got to go through that process, and I got to share my deepest, darkest secrets with somebody. And he shared some very similar things with me, you know. And that's the process of connection there. You know, that's what opened the door for me to become vulnerable with another man. And honestly, you know, I mean, throughout that process, I mean, you guys heard me share in my talk, those that were here, you know, I was not fully bought into this yet. And so that vulnerability and that deep connection that I had with him in that fifth step was vital for me, you know, to go through the rest of the process. And then for, you know, what happened in the ninth step to me that just completely rocked my world, you know? And that had to happen there. You know, inventory since then, they've looked a lot different. The expectation has been different. I've had to write a lot of inventory on relationships, you know? I mean, and then I met a girl, you know? I mean, that was my story. And you know, I grew up in a pretty broken family, very dysfunctional, alcoholic family. Dad wasn't there. Mom was a narcissist, you know, still in active alcoholism. And and that has transferred over to how I show up in relationships today, you know. In 2016, I had been with a girl for about 6 years, and on my 8-year birthday, she came home, and she told me it was over. And it was devastating. Never saw it coming. And the thing about that was, is that, like, when I got into that inventory process, and we really got into, like, the thick of it, just, like, the real raw, just experience that happened throughout that relationship. I mean, I was on the front end of a spiritual experience when we got together. So the version of that she saw of me when we got together 6 years prior was completely different than the asshole I'd become. But I had no idea. And the inventory process is what brought that out of me. You know? Up here, it makes no sense. It makes no sense. But if I can download that to paper, then I get to see it for what it really is, you know. And I must have wrote 17 4-steps on that girl that year, man. I mean, it was hard. It was hard. Because I mean, it was just the mind. It was the ego. It's how you viewed me. It was the stage characters that I had created for myself. You know, it was the what are people going to think about me? Like, this girl left me, and I'm devastated, and I'm broken, you know, and now I'm scared to talk to girls, and I'm, you know, like, I'm so scared of entering another relationship. I've got this commitment thing, and it was just how you guys viewed me, and it was all based around the ego. And I'm just a firm believer that, like, we have to have people in our lives to kind of guide us through those processes when we're in those deep, dark times. That was the darkest time of my life. And I honestly have no idea how I didn't take a drink. But I think a lot of writing had a lot to do with it. I think for the first 6 months after that breakup, man, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd cry and I'd get out the pen and the paper and I'd start writing and then I'd call the sponsor and then I'd hit a meeting that night and I did a whole lot of other unhealthy shit, just to be clear. But I'm just so grateful for the sponsor-sponsee relationship that has kind of guided me through just everything that's happened over the course of the years. And I'm not exactly sure, you know, what else to share. Do you have anything else that you want to share right now, or do you want to go ahead and open up for questions? Or
let's do questions. So okay. If you have a question, let us know for whom.
Cool. That's all I got.
Any questions? No questions. If they don't have questions, ask them.
You guys were so clear.
Okay.
Okay.
You mentioned about dating. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a psychotherapist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not here to fix your brain. So, at what point do you think that digging goes into that line, and at what point do you think the digging stops at being a sponsor? You see what I'm trying to ask?
Sure. Yeah.
The question is for Rush, and it is, he talked about digging. What is there a line between digging too far if you're just a sponsor versus a therapist?
Honestly, I'm really glad that you brought this up because I think it's an opportunity to speak to my experience with both. You know, I can only share my experience that I've had in the fifth step and just how grateful I am that I had a man that said, man, are you sure that's it? You know, are you sure that's it? And that's all he had to say. That was all he had to say. And I just sat there in silence, and he knew. He knew what time it was. He was like, all right, let's just sit here until this guy's got enough courage to speak up and talk about, you know, what he's scared of. So, you know, that's my experience. And honestly, I mean, it's real simple. That's the extent of it. You know, I just believe that as a sponsor, it is my duty, you know, to look to that man and just say, hey, man, are you sure there's nothing else you want to share with me? You know, because I've got some pretty dark shit in my past, too. And if you do want to share it with me, like, I want you to understand that you're in a safe place. And whatever you tell me stays here. I am a vault, you know, and that's it, you know. By all means, I don't ever want anybody to think that I'm a therapist. I'm not a clinician, you know. I do believe that there's a time and a place for that, you know. And I'll share this. You know, last year I got around some people that had been heavily involved in therapy, and they suggested to me, you know, hey, Rush, you might want to consider kind of looking at this stuff, just because we've heard some of the stories about your family dynamics, and we know you know you've had some struggles in relationships. You might want to consider it. You know, I'm not telling you what to do. I did that. I started trauma therapy about a year and a half ago, and it has been probably the biggest amount of growth that I've had over the course of like the last 5 years. So I you know, there's a time and a place for that, but I do believe there comes a time when, because what I want to do is I want to continue to grow spiritually. That's what I want. I want to continue on that path, and I believe that therapy has helped me do that. So just kind of a side note, I wanted to throw that out there. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob.
Every person is supposed to decide if you have become a real alcoholic.
How often do you guys do this?
I find myself
having
to do
this every single year.
Do you
want to
answer?
No, you go.
Well, question is for both of us. How often do we do an inventory?
Oh, she said both of us.
Yeah, both of us. So for me, if I'm current on my steps, I don't need to go back and do an inventory. I'm doing it in step 10. But what happened for me is when I went through that horrible depression, I went from being, you know, active. I remember I would get a resentment, and this is going to date me, but I would be driving down the street and I'd stop at a payphone and I'd call Marilyn. I'd be like, I've got to read you a four column, because I took everything so, like, that there was only one way to do it. If I didn't do it, I would drink again. So for me, it's, I know some people do it annually, but for me, as long as I'm up to date in 10, 11, and 12, I don't need to do an annual inventory. It's just when my inventory gets backed up, it's time to take a look at it. So the job for me today with long-term sobriety is just to stay current. That's just been my experience.
Thanks, Georgia. Thanks, Georgia. Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think, you know, I've heard the rule of thumb, like, as alcoholics, we should go through this once a year. I think that applied to me for the first several years of my sobriety. My experience has been that, how do I say this? I mean, I used to get so mad and angry and resentful about the dumbest shit. I mean, it was just so stupid, you know? And it was real. I mean, it was my experience, and that's fine. You know, there's no judgment there. But, I mean, most of the time today, I just don't go there anymore, you know? And I think the reason that I don't go there is that, you know, I do a much better job about staying accountable with people in my life. You know, the honesty and transparency piece, I mean, it's been everything for me. You know, if I look back over the course of my sobriety and like what I can attribute that to, it's the fact that I'm unwilling to lie about my experience today, no matter how dark it gets. So I just talk to people about that stuff as it comes up. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I do some scripting every single morning, and I talk about, you know, I talk about the things that are like bothering me. But I also believe that, you know, I'm still so flawed, you know, like mentally, that like I need the guidance and direction of people around me. And I think I've done a pretty good job about keeping like really solid people that are on the spiritual path around me that can help me see through the bullshit. So that being said, I mean, as needed. You know, sometimes it's every 30 days and you know, but again, I mean, I've done the full blown inventories, where I've got six or seven people on the list, and I've done the spot check where I just meet with a sponsor on a Sunday afternoon and I just talk about, you know, the boss that I currently hate, you know? That's it.
Thanks, Ryan.
Good morning, I'm being an alcoholic. Thank you so much for your service. When I get with a sponsee, and I'm working real hard, take it out of the book. I don't have a lot of forms. I want them to be able to take it right out of the book. And so, if you do this, like the top is Mr. Brown, and he's got the cause and the attention to my wife, and then you got to affect mine. And so, sometimes I say, well, what does that affect? And so we'll come up with something, but then what do I do with that? And so we end up talking about it, and I feel like sometimes is there another column? I hear about that. And then like it says on this, it affects my sex relations or fear. And so then you kind of go into a fear inventory. I know I'm not making any sense, but I just kind of feel like sometimes, what do I do with that once they write it down? And then they talk to me, and then we start another fear inventory. Am I on the right track? And it takes a lot for me to say all this in front of a room of people. So I just want to... It's kind of been a question. I don't know
if that's even a question. It's going to be a hard question to repeat.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to do this, but go back to the beginning. That was a lot. Are you just specifically talking about the second column there?
Yeah, so they have what's the cause, what are they resentful at, and then they got the self-esteem and the fear, and then we kind of just go into a fear inventory, and I read the book and everything, and I just want to make sure I get it all covered.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you probably are getting it all covered. I mean, I think that you probably are. I think a lot of this process is just trying to bring awareness. You know, because like when I look back to my first inventory, I mean, I just had no idea. I thought that you guys were going to teach me how to forgive people. You know what I mean? I had no idea that it was my part there. And like what it affected or even like what sex relations meant. You know? I mean, I thought it just had to do with like people that I had sex with. That's not the case at all, you know, and the self-esteem piece and the list goes on. So, I think like the meat and potatoes of it is in that fourth column, like as sponsors, like when we're taking somebody through the process and just helping them see how they showed up in that resentment. You know what I mean? And like what their part is, you know? I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I have. That's great.
It gets better and better every time, and I know when it'll keep getting better and better. So I just wanted to say that.
Well, and I think the rule of thumb is that you sponsor people the way you're sponsored. So, and the book talks about you go back to that three column, and now you do what we call the fourth column, even though it's not outlined there. There's not a fourth column on that page, but that's we do that fourth column where we look at where did we get the ball rolling, what was our fault. That the fourth column is where the magic lies, and that's where today when I have a resentment, I just want to get to that fourth column because that's where my freedom lies. Again, the only access to power I have is on my side of the street. I don't want to miss any more moments. I've missed so much in my life, you know, being angry and drunk and depressed, and When I have a resentment, I'm like, I want to get to that fourth column where I can see what it is about me that I can change. What can I do differently? And get busy about getting back to the moment, you know, because all I have is this moment right now. I don't want to miss anymore. And that fourth column is where it lies, although it's not outlined there. If you continue to read, it does talk about that fourth column. I did want to say, because you brought this up, and I don't talk about this very often because it's kind of a long story, but I'm going to try. I'm going to look at my clock just so I don't go over like a minute or two. We have time. So I came out of that suicidal depression. I went through the steps again, beefed up my program. I was able to leave that second marriage that I talked about. I shouldn't have been on a second date with that guy. And but we walked, like, we became really genuinely good friends. He volunteered at the Midnight Mission for the last 10 years of his life. He had a massive heart attack and he died, and we were good, you know. That's not me. That's AA. I don't do relationships well and I don't end relationships well. So that's all AA. But what happened for me is I got the job at the Midnight Mission. I'd just gone through the steps again. I beefed up my program, made like a newcomer, and I finally became complete. Like, finally, I wasn't looking for someone to complete me. And that's when I fell in love. I met this man at a Midnight Mission event that I had gone to. And he was a normie. And he was everything I wasn't. He was somebody I would never have been attracted to. He, you know, I like a lot of the F words. I like them mixed with some M words. And I don't know how it's possible that I do this. I don't cuss from a podium, but somehow I have the inability to not cuss when I'm away from a podium. I don't know what that is, so it's me. But anyway, he would say things like, holy crap, and, you know, like, he didn't cuss. He was sweet. He was from the Midwest. He was a DJ on our classic rock station that I'd listened to since I was a kid. And so we shared this love of music, and he and I took it so slow. We started dating, writing letters to each other, and then, I mean, I didn't get a U-Haul on the second date. We didn't move in until we were together 3 years. I mean, we took things so slow. I knew his family. I knew everyone he worked with. We would go to sleep at night holding hands. We'd either, like, watch something, or we'd read. We used to love reading David Sedaris, and we'd laugh our butts off. Or we'd listen to music, and then we'd wake up in the morning and he'd make me coffee and he'd make me a little lunch for work, and he'd write, like, on my sandwich bag a sweet note, and on my chips bag a little sweet note, and he'd walk me out to my car and I'd drive off to work, and he would do some research for his radio show, because he was on the radio every day. And during the day we'd text and call, and, you know, just, it was the sweetest life I could have ever imagined. And I kept feeling something in my gut wasn't right. And my sponsor and my friend said, you're crazy. This is the best thing that's ever happened to you. I've never known anybody to be more committed to another person. I'm like, it's me. I'm crazy. You're right. But I couldn't shake that feeling. And then he had a surprise party for me for my 20th birthday. I'm like, oh, maybe that was that feeling. But I still couldn't shake it. And a few months after my 20-year birthday party, I just shot up in bed one night, and I thought, I just have to know. And I grabbed his phone and I went into the bathroom, and it was the beginning of discovering a secret life that he had. Yeah. And I'm proud of myself for this, and it reminds me of something you said, which was the first thing I said to him was, what's up? You know, I said, I can't imagine how lonely this has been for you. And I was so proud of myself for saying that. That was before I broke his phone and his guitar, but that came later. There was a moment of grace. Everything that I do in my life, working at the Midnight Mission with homeless people in AA, is based on the idea that people can change. And so if I didn't bring that into my home, then I felt like I was a hypocrite. And I said, I'm willing to stay if we seek, because he was not in recovery. He was a normal person, I thought, up until then. But if you're willing to go to therapy, if we can tell our friends, this was a secret, not that he was bragging to his guy friends about, nobody in his life knew. He had all these different personas, and anyway, all told, it turned out that he was involved with about 30 other women. Well, that's where I lost track. And it was LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, Skype, photos, videos on his phone. I mean, like, there were so many women and so many things. But the thing that made this, that made it possible for me to stay and try and work it out, was that I knew my side of the street was clean. I was the best I'd ever been in a relationship. I had not one regret. I didn't think, oh, I should have worn cuter things to bed, or I should have cooked more, or I should have been sweeter, I shouldn't have been crazy. Like, if we had an argument, I immediately called Marilyn, my sponsor, like, this is what happened, identify what my role was, make prompt amends. I had never been as clean, but what I learned from this experience is that I had developed a new old idea. And that is that I had never been perfect in a relationship before. You know, like, I had never been without regret in a relationship before. And I developed this new old idea, which was, if I were perfect, if my side of the street, and I'm, by perfect, you know what I mean, like, without regret, if my side of the street was clean, that somehow it would work out, that somehow that would change the other person. And so I did so many inventories on this because I never wanted this to happen to me again. And what happened was everything came out. We started seeing a therapist. We told our friends. But I was really, really messed up for a long time. I mean, this was the person I trusted most in the world. I felt like I was going down a roller coaster really fast all the time. My stomach, I couldn't function. I would go to meetings and to work, but the rest of the time, sometimes I would just sit and stare at a wall at home. Like, I was really broken for a long time. But I couldn't figure out, and finally I ended up leaving because he kept saying, that's all, now you know everything, and then I'd find something else out. And I don't know if he was still doing the behavior, but I was still finding out more. And it just, I stayed, I couldn't decide if I should stay or go, and Marilyn always said, you can't go back and forth, so are you leaving today? You either leave, or you accept things exactly as they are. And I'm like, no, I want the third option. He gets better, it works out. She's like, no, you leave or you accept things as they are. And eventually I got to the day where I couldn't accept things as they are. So, and I had perfect clarity, which I didn't think I'd have because I loved this man so much. I'd never been happier in my whole life, and I'd never had anybody hurt me that much in my entire life, drunk or sober. And so I did the inventories, and I was like, what's my fourth column? What's my fourth column? I mean, I asked everyone, what do you think my fourth column is? What do you think my fourth column is? Again, just like when I was new, trying to figure it out. And we just couldn't, you know, it's just like sometimes people are just, sometimes you have a justified resentment, which are the worst in the world. When there's nothing, like, there's nothing I did in that relationship that I would do differently now, is what I thought. It took a couple of years for it to finally sink in that what my role in that was, is that I didn't ask questions when I felt the discomfort. When words and actions didn't match, I didn't ask. I grew up in a house where words and actions didn't match. I was used to it. I filled in the blanks. Like, I was in a band, and he would say, gosh, I really wish I could be there tonight. And he had no other plans. And we used to joke, my bandmates, we'd put a chair in the room, and he'd say, I'll be there in spirit. And we'd say, oh, there's his spirit. And but I never asked why he couldn't be there. You know, like, there were just weird things, or if there was strange behavior, I didn't ask. And so in the relationship I'm in now, I ask. That's the only thing that I could figure out from that. So, like, my current boyfriend, he's on his phone at midnight, and I'm like, you know, it, like, sets off that thing, you know, and I'm like, hey, babe, I noticed you're texting someone at midnight. You know, what's up there? And he's like, oh, I'm just writing down my food for the day, babe. And I'm like, oh, cool, you know, but And he knows what I've been through, and he's absolutely open to that. But I got, it was so hard to identify what that fourth column was for me. And today it's that when words and actions don't match, I have to ask the question, even though I'm afraid you're not going to like me if I ask the question. But it was such a painful thing, and it reminded me of what you said, and I'm sorry, that was such a long story. Are there any other questions?
It's just an opinion, but I think it's like kind of undeniable that a thorough fifth step can really shape like our integrity. How much do you talk to your girls about that before they do? Like, how much do you talk to your girls about the thoroughness and the importance of a really thorough fifth step before they start writing their fourth?
Okay, so how much do I talk to my sponsees about writing a thorough fourth step before they start writing? Well, I mean, I think it's similar to what Rush said, that, you know, they write what they write, and then I ask questions. But yeah, all of my sponsees know how I roll. I set the example. I'm, you know, fiercely honest. I ask them to be, I mean, I don't think it's just when you're writing your four step. It's, I think about when I talk to my sponsor, as my sponsor is sponsor computer. I need to enter all the facts to get the right equation, you know, for the correct answer. And if I don't know all the facts, if they're holding something back, then they're not going to get direction that's really going to help them, you know. So, yes, with the inventory. You know, I just did an inventory with a girl who's 21, and she wrote three binders full, and I'm like, you cannot have this much at 21. and I did, that was my inside voice. And I asked my sponsor, I'm like, oh my God, like, what am I going to do? And she said, well, she would ask them to cut it in half. And I just couldn't, because I felt like I wanted to honor the work that she did, and I felt like it was an honor to spend the time listening. She did all the work, you know, so it was, oh my God in heaven. It was like 5 sessions. It was so long. But I also feel like it bonded us together too. And I wanted her to be thorough. I told her to be thorough. I'm going to be really careful about how I phrase that going forward though.
Thank you so much.
God, that was amazing.
Kathy?
Somebody had a question?
Kathy, are you
going to
answer?
I wasn't going to answer. But if you have a question, go ahead. I can save this for after. Sorry.
I'm Kathy Alcoholic. Kathy. So my question is about if each of you could speak to any, you know, memories or experiences of transformation that you've had receiving.
All right, say the last part again. I kind of lost it.
Listening
to a fifth step?
Yes.
Okay.
For you, like, if you've had any aha's or, I mean, I know we do, but just from your own experience. No? Stop them.
So the question was, have there been any memorable experiences in receiving a fifth step and listening to a fifth step? And I can't think of like one like aha moment other than the experience of somebody who feels like I did, completely alone, that I'm the only one who had this experience, and listening to them and seeing them be set free. I did a fifth step with a sponsee recently, and I've never had this where most of her stuff, I was baffled by what her fourth column was. I mean, her mom, oh my God, her mom was so abusive and physically abused her. Yeah, I mean, there's in such gory, graphic ways, and it was really difficult. It was really that kind of how my sponsor helped me identify how I've used that since, but that she had no role in that. But I think it's also, I am always surprised how much hearing a fist step makes me fall more in love with my sponsee. Like, the more I know about you, the more I love you. And it's so funny. We're always trying to protect ourselves and make sure that people don't know those things about us that we think are ugly or that are, you know, unlovable. And those are the things that really bond us together. You know, I think about, and this is, anyway, I've shared this when I do a fist step with people too, like My Funny Valentine, you know, that song, that the thing that attracts us to each other is not always that it's the perfection. It's the thing that's not perfect about us. It's that little quirk. It's that your smile's crooked, or, you know, there's some sort of thing. And likewise with our stories, it's those unique parts about us that make us so lovable. And so doing a fist step with a sponsee always makes me fall in love with them more. Never, never less. Never have I done an inventory with someone and thought, well, she's a real piece of crap. Never.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I mean, outside of, I'm thinking about like the one of the first guys that I sponsored, that I started sponsoring this time around. You know, just sitting down with a guy who was, just like Georgia just mentioned, who was just as broken as I was, just so scared of life, so scared to, you know, I remember, you know, just first meeting the guy, and I mean, he just, it was just so clear he just hated himself, like, to his core. And just to be a part of, like, just like the beginning stages of, like, his process, like, I mean, he's not sober now, but, like, he sent me a Facebook message a month ago, you know, just like telling me like, hey man, like, I just love you and I miss you and I'm still living in Hawaii, but I just wanted to tell you that, like, I still think about you all the time, you know? So, I mean, I don't know if it's an aha moment, but it's just really cool that, like, we get to be a part of that process. And then the last guy that I sponsored, who's also not doing well. I don't think I'm a very good sponsor. But, you know, we start this journey so blind. Like, we're just so unconscious. And that's okay. Again, there's no judgment there. You know, like, I'm gonna get 10 years down the road and I'm gonna look to right here, right now. And I'm gonna say, God, I was still so unconscious. Right? Just cause, like, we continue to grow. You know, but, like, I think back to, like, when I first started the process, and, I mean, I just truly had no idea. Like, I just had no idea. And I got to shed some light to a guy about his codependency and his just very sick, twisted relationship with his mother. You know? I think for the very first time. You know? And that may have something to do with, you know, kind of where he's at right now. I mean, I have no idea. Again, I don't think that I tried to show up as like a therapist in that situation, but, you know, I think that I just tried to just be honest about my own experience, because I had a very similar experience when I was growing up with my own mother and just the codependency there. And there's something that tells me that him and I will have much contact through the years if he lives. Just because, like, we just got raw, you know, like, he just bared it all. You know what I mean? And there's something to be said about that, you know? Outside of that, I think that's it, though.
Yes, sir.
Jordan, I'm not well. I was just curious about the process you used for the second column in the fear inventory, where I believe in the book it says we asked ourselves why we had this fear, and I've had inventories where it's very literal. Well, why do you have this fear of being cheated on? Because I was cheated on. But then I've had other inventories where sponsors wanted me to, like, go down the rabbit hole to find the root of the fear, and what is it? What am I really afraid of? And it's not the surface fear that I'm listing. So I just wanted your experience on the second column of the fear inventory.
Don't get up.
experience on the second column of the fear inventory. Why do we have the fear? I haven't had anybody who's done the why of that. I know people do that on the fourth column too, the third column of the resentments, like the why's of all of those, and then it always gets down to fear of death or something. But that, it hasn't been my experience. My sponsor has us do just really simply the why you, what the fear is, why you have it, and what the spiritual solution is, or what we think the spiritual solution is. But I've never had anybody do any further digging. It's been pretty clear, and then we talk about it. The third column of that fear, you know, I wrote mine super sarcastically. Like, I have a fear, I've had it since I was a kid, that I'm going to be stabbed in the back, in between my shoulder blades. I've never been able to sleep with my back out toward a room. I always slept with my back toward the wall, and so I couldn't figure out, like, what's the spiritual solution to that, you know? So I wrote, because I'm in AA, everything's going to be great. And because I was mad. I'm like, this isn't my fault that I have a stupid fear. And Marilyn said, I think the solution is that if it happens, that God will be with you. And I'm like, I don't know. Do you have any fear digging?
Sure.
Fear digging?
Fear digging. Marilyn's so well.
Yeah, is her talk, like, recorded anywhere or anything?
Yes.
It is? Okay, I got to hear this. Yeah. You know, when you mentioned the why, I thought about this therapist that I had one time. I think that's the only time that I've ever had somebody do that. It was really enlightening, though. Like, I mean, you talk about digging. I mean, we went back. We went to a dark place, you know, at least for me. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the fear inventory, you know, typically what I've done with sponsors is, I mean, not that it's like an afterthought. I mean, like, that's where we go. And it seems like a lot of the resentments that I have start with, like, a fear of, like, being disrespected. And it's all about the ego. It's all related to, like, how I look, you know, and, like, the character that I present to you, you know, and, like, what, like, how you guys view that. You know, but as far as the fears go, yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, that's what the resentments are all about. You know, that's what they've always been. Like, what am I scared of here? You know, like, why do I get resentful? Well, it's always because I'm scared, you know? So, that's it.
So, one last question.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you what your panel is. With
choosing someone in whom to confide your fifth step. And, like, in the 12 says, like, well, it's usually going to be your sponsor, but maybe not. And then there's I don't understand after all with it may turn out, however, that you choose someone else for the more difficult and deeper revelations. Maybe somebody entirely outside of AA, for example, your clergyman or your pastor, your doctor, or this. For some of us, a complete stranger may prove the best bet. And that just throws me. But anyway, any thoughts you might have about choosing who to confide in?
Repeat the question.
Yeah, so the question is, you know, he asked what our thoughts are about choosing someone to do a fifth step with. I mean, again, you know, I think I kind of went over this in, like, you know, the first discussion that, you know, that when I came up here and spoke. And my experience has been that I'm just kind of, like, led. I'm just led to, like, where I need to be. That has just been my experience. And, you know, it's really shitty because, excuse my language, I haven't dropped an F-bomb up here all weekend, though. So that's the good news. So I have heard lots of experiences of people choosing the wrong person to share their fifth step with. It has just never happened to me. We just want to find somebody competent, you know, and when I,
I just remember being in a meeting and I remember hearing my sponsor share and me just thinking, okay, that's somebody that can be trusted. You know, so I mean, without sounding like a broken record here, like that's what I want to find. I just want to find somebody that I can trust. I have no experience with, you know, finding a complete stranger. I think some of that stuff is related to like legal issues and like, I mean, I don't know, but I just have no experience with that.
I feel very passionately about this one, but this is just my opinion. And, so I know I'm with the right sponsor if I can answer yes to two questions. One is, do I want what they have and do I trust their judgment? If I can answer yes to those two questions, I know I'm with the right sponsor. You know, there's times I get like, well, maybe I've outgrown this sponsor. Maybe it's time for a new one. You know, or I have crazy thoughts like that, but I go back to those two questions or I'm mad at her because I think she doesn't approve of something I'm going through and I'm like, oh, she's not the right sponsor. Two questions, always been able to answer yes to. So when I read my inventory to someone, I want my sponsor to know, I feel like she's going to be guiding my life. She's the one I'm going to for direction. She's the one that I'm trusting. I want her to have all the information because I feel like the more information she has, the better she can guide me and help me to make the right decision for me. It may not be the right decision for her, and that's what she does. She guides me. But I've also found that there's nothing you can know about me today that can hurt me. I mean, if I'm still doing it, yes, then I'm more protective. You know, like if I'm embezzling from work and I need to, you know, talk to somebody about it, or I'm doing something that's dangerous currently, then yes, that could hurt me. But things that I'm no longer doing, there's nothing you can know about me that can hurt me. So I have not heard of anybody having a bad experience with a fifth step. And who they chose. But I think I also come from a super structured group. In case you didn't know about the Pacific group, we're super structured. And so it's tradition in our group, and I'm sure other people have done it differently, but that we do our fifth step with our sponsor. And that's been my experience. And selfishly, because I want my sponsor to know, the more she knows about me, the better I feel like she can help me. So I think that's all the time we have. Yeah. Thank you for your questions.